Hey guys, it's Lauren back with episode 2 of the Depolarizers podcast, where we talk to those who are effectively working to depolarize American politics. Last week, we spoke with Matt Iglesias and Sam Rosenfeld on the history of polarization and how that affects us today. On today's episode, we talk with Reid Galen and Eitan Hersh on how the red dogs turn blue, how suburban Republicans are increasingly voting for modern Democrats, and the effects of political hobbyism on all of that. Thanks so much for joining us, and let's get into it. Eitan Hersh is a professor of political science at Tufts University. His research focuses on U.S. elections and civic participation. Hersh is the author of Politics is for Power, Hacking the Electorate, and other scholarly articles. Hersh earned his PhD from Harvard in 2011 and served as assistant professor of political science at Yale University from 2011 to 2017. Reid Galen is an independent political strategist and co-founder of the Lincoln Project, which was founded in 2019 by former Republican strategists who sought to defeat Trump in the 2020 election and worked to protect and sustain American democracy. Reid has spent more than a decade advising large corporations and before that worked on high-profile ballot measures and campaigns for John McCain and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Reid and Eitan, it's great to have you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
So Reid, you have co-founded the Lincoln Project, so you know all about these anti-Trump Republicans. Can you talk more about how essentially the party left them and people feel essentially disenfranchised and disengaged and homeless essentially as voters? And it created a new swath of the electorate for moderate Democrats, essentially like President Biden. Can you talk about how the rise of extremist Republicans created this new electorate for Democrats?
Sure. And thanks for having me, Lauren. I think it's important to understand that, look, I left the Republican Party in 2016 when it was clear that Donald Trump was going to be the nominee. I think more people, if they haven't left the party, don't consider themselves Republicans like they knew, like I knew. I worked for George W. Bush. I worked for John McCain. I worked for Arnold Schwarzenegger. I think you saw them spike or reappear as a group for Nikki Haley earlier this year. Now, I think it's important to understand that I think that a lot of these people, maybe, let me say this, probably a plurality of these people might have crossed the line for Joe Biden in 2020. I think they probably did the same again for Democratic candidates like Gretchen Whitmer or Tony Evers or Josh Shapiro in 2022. I think, though, it's probably a harder sell to get them all the way across the line to a Joe Biden this year, Lauren. I think getting them to stay home or to leave President blank is doable. That's not to say some of them won't come across the line for Biden, but I think that where we saw, a real consolidated effort in 20 to get these folks across the line and a lot of them willing to do so, I think it's tougher now, even though MAGA has expanded its reach, not only through the party, but down into certainly red states. And so I think the non-Trump Republican coalition is broader. But I think, unfortunately, it will be harder to get them to a Joe Biden. That doesn't necessarily mean it will be harder to get them to an Alyssa Slotkin or someone like that. But there does seem to be this mental slash political block on Biden amongst these people. Now, that doesn't mean that their opting out of the presidential isn't beneficial to Biden. But I think it might be one vote in the right direction instead of two, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. And I'm wondering what you think specifically like a Slotkin has on Biden. Are there certain elements to President Biden's character or policies or whatever that are maybe making people think, like you said, to leave it blank versus actually voting for him?
I think, unfortunately, a lot of it in this is across the board. It's not just for Republicans. I think it's his age. I don't necessarily think that it's true that he has, lost a step cognitively, but I think that the Republicans and Trump have done an excellent job of utilizing that as a disqualifier for Biden. And I think the Democrats have done a terrible job of pushing back on that or highlighting Trump's insanity on a regular or continuing basis.
Yeah, we do a lot of awesome work with the Blueprint, and they put out polling all the time on people just quite frankly not even knowing what President Biden's policies have been that they actually really enjoy and agree with. And so they only see the glaringly obvious things like his age when they consider whether or not they're wanting to vote for him, but they don't necessarily hear about the things that he's doing that they actually really agree with and could get behind. Awesome. Well, I'm going to switch it over a little bit to Eitan's group. A portion of the conversation here. So Eitan, you wrote a really great book called Politics is for Power several years ago, which seems so prophetic and great for the times that we're seeing today. Your book really talked about how people could create essentially opportunities to engage instead of just complaining about something. How does political hobbyism, as you coined it in your book, play into people essentially saying, I'm not just going to, tweet about this and be mad. I'm going to activate and vote for a Democrat, like Reed was saying.
I don't know if it's going to help them vote for a Democrat, but I think it's going to probably moderate their politics. So many people, the vast majority of people who are cognitively engaged in politics, never really have the experience of politics as human interaction. So, they have, of course, they tweet something or they argue with people on Facebook or they watch some dumb viral videos, and that's sort of their exposure to politics. And in the book, what I tried to do was showcase those kinds of people, but the ones who, instead of just doing that, go and actually build either a policy coalition or political coalition in their communities. And, I think the obvious thing that happens when anyone ever does real politics, and he's like, when I mean real politics, I mean either policy advocacy at the state or local level or coalition building. So you're trying to get votes. I want this state legislative candidate to win, so I know I need an extra 1,000 votes. And then you go to those doors and count those votes. It's moderating because there's another human on the other side. You get a sense of in real time what they respond well to, what they don't respond well to, what the kinds of talking points your party might have that come across just terribly to a normal person at the door, what resonates. And it's humbling. It's very hard work. And it's moderating in the sense that you just sort of learn that even your neighbor in a community that might be of relatively like-minded people just might disagree with you. And, there might be some common ground. It might be on this particular issue, but on that issue. And you reorient your whole political self toward being strategic as opposed to being non-strategic, which is how 95% of the political world is non-strategic. And it's terrible. It's polarizing.
Yeah. And when we think about, essentially some of the ways, the places we're seeing these things happen, do you have a sense of where you feel like some of this decision to, and this is for Reed as well, but people essentially standing up, you talked about Haley voters. So we're seeing Haley voters in Michigan and other places. Are there places where we see more prominence of Republicans who are wanting to combat extremism by voting for someone like Haley, or even again, coming over to vote for President Biden?
I mean, my basic take is this, there are, even at the state and local level, you can play an insider strategy or an outsider strategy. And a lot of times, particularly as people sort of age into their communities and they want to lean into community service, they start to play an insider strategy and they tend to be moderate and they push back on both sides. I think, the NIMBYs in the fight against YIMBYs in communities around development are often, older people in the community who sort of see their role not as politically, particularly partisan or ideological, but they just sort of want to keep things status quo. And you see them pushing back against both sides. But there's also this up and down of an outsider strategy in local communities where you see essentially, the Tea Party giving way to the resistance people, giving way to the MAGA people, and eventually if Trump wins, it'll go back to the to the resistance people. And in that process, some of those people really do turn into quite effective long-term strategist. It might be the people who run for county election clerk and they ran because they're activists on the right, and then they actually need to run the election system, and that tends to be moderating to actually do the job. And so, they do that. I think we saw a lot of this on school board politics in the last few years where you can see people, parents get, agitated about critical race theory or gender roles as they're taught in school. So they get roped into a school board meeting and, most of the people just fall away, but some of them decide to run for school board. And then, so I think you see in any direction, once you're caught up in that wave. And I think a lot of the sort of like the Trump era resistance people were, some of those stay and become long-term engaged people in their communities.
Yeah, but do you think we're seeing enough moderate people wanting to step up to combat some of the extremism? Like, I don't know, like Reid, you've been in politics for a while and have done lots of campaigns. Like, do you find that we're seeing people who are willing to moderate the electorate, whether it's a school board or a federal office, more often now?
I think is the answer, but I don't think that for a lot of voters, it's a conscious decision, if that makes sense, which is I'm doing this to moderate extremism. They might do it in the context of I'm willing to vote for someone I don't know that well or someone different than the insane school board member because I don't like the fact that they're crazy, if that makes sense. But I don't think it's a larger strategic thing of them saying, I am pushing back on extremism because extremism is bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In the abstract, if you ask them after the fact, yeah, you know, I don't like the extremism on my school board, but I don't think there's a larger mission in individual voters, if that makes sense. But that being said, I do think that, and we have seen this in both smaller, you know, unique elections like the mayor of Jacksonville or the mayor of Colorado Springs, Colorado, where even if those are nonpartisan elections, everybody knows there's a Republican and a Democrat. The moderate, competent, confident Democrat will beat the MAGA, right? Should beat the MAGA. And I think you're going to see that in a lot of U.S. Senate races. I think you'll probably see that in a lot of U.S. House races. The Senate's a little bit different, but, you know, I mean, again, I think Tester's someone who's a moderate Democrat in Montana, who's just running against a carpetbagger, right? So like that's a different dynamic. Some of these races have individual dynamics. Trump is different in that he's ubiquitous, right? And it's the ultimate national election. So I think that combating extremism is, I don't even know what the right word is for it. Eitan is the professor. He probably has the dictionary definition for it. So I don't think that it's necessarily motivating to say you have to combat extremism, right? I think it's more of, does this person represent how you see the world and do you want that person or not? And I think that amongst Republicans, right, this fight against whatever MAGA is won't really begin until and unless Trump is gone. And then it will be quite a fight, right? It's not like MAGA has seeped in. Its poison has seeped in deep into a lot of places. It's not going away, you know, because Trump has gone away, but it doesn't start, from my perspective anyway, until and unless he's defeated.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't want to interrupt Eitan if you wanted to add anything. So in thinking about going back to the conversation about beating extremists, you know, we talked before about how the future of polarization, and even to your point, Reid, like the future of MAGA, you know, what is the role of someone who is willing to be a depolarizer, lean into their communities, run on issues that, you know, really are affecting people's day-to-day lives? What is that impact on the future of polarization? Like, do you think that we'll see less polarization in the future? I know you said that, Reid, just now, that, you know, Trump winning or losing will have a lot to do with it, but I'm just curious to the both of y'all, you know, what do you think that will look like in the future if we do continue to do this?
I mean, look, I think that there is a story going on under the surface, which is at the state level, in many states, we do see moderation. Having to balance budgets at a state level has that effect. But I think that there's just a widespread problem that each party doesn't do a good job policing its extremists. And so, you know, if you think about the Democrats right now as an example, they unfortunately have gone down the path of basically like they thought that calling everyone a MAGA Republican is a winner. So there are many people who basically think all Republicans are MAGA Republicans. They think that anyone winning who is a MAGA Republican is a existential threat to democracy. And they're totally blind to examples on the Democratic side that they would just be like mortified if they happened on the Republican side. So just like a couple of quick examples. Stacey Abrams on her own election stuff in Georgia, which the Washington Post has very clearly defined as essentially as election denial. Like, she should not be welcome in the company of people who are really caring about the transition of power and fair and free elections. Another example, you know, what Biden has done after the Supreme Court decision related to the college forgiveness. If Trump had done it, Democrats would call it, you know, he's finding every which way to deny what the Supreme Court says. And so party coalitions need to carve out space for that kind of dissent. And I don't think either party is particularly doing a good job on it. It turns out that very few people in the world, very few, are actually like principally committed to like process arguments. They are really just like if something is... If some anti-democratic thing happens to be consistent with their values, they'll support it. However, I don't think that's actually that might be like the right way for an academic to describe it. If you're just a run-of-the-mill politician, the right thing to do is just to stay out of the fray with all this stuff and probably not engage in telling which party they're not consistent with their values. Just stay focused on bread and butter issues. That's how I would sort of see it. But I do think like collectively the broader party coalitions need to do a lot better job policing their own sides.
But I would say this is that there's little economics, political or financial in that, unfortunately, in this time, right? Because outrage drives dollars. Outragement, for it's not a real word, but outrage drives engagement, right? And this is all, we're an eyeballs economy. And I'd be lying if I said I didn't use that, right? I mean, for me, what is the fastest way to make an impact in a political construct, to drive an emotional response, whether or not that's anger, fear, sadness, joy, whatever it is. I mean, we forget that politics is an emotional game. Governance, different, maybe. But politics is a binary choice. You're going to win, you're going to lose. And so, yes, bread and butter issues matter, but only in the context that a campaign or a party is making the legitimate case for why they're better on those issues. But that's a sense of belief, right? And I think this, as a former Republican, I can tell you, this is why Republicans are good at politics or better at politics, the bare knuckles piece of it, the Democrats, which is Republicans understand that you fight these races in terms of narratives, stories, and values. Democrats want to fight in the context of issues and what I'm going to give you. They make it too transactional, frankly. And I think that's also why you see, Lauren, cycle after cycle, Democrats have to go convince their voters to show up again, right? What are you going to do for me this time? Because you've conditioned your voters to be expecting something. Whereas Republicans say, here's election day, show up, and they salute and march forward.
I love that. And I don't think we talk enough about that, Reid, particularly on the Democratic side, because, man, when it is so transactional, it does create the expectation that you are having to bring something to the table every time to earn a vote, which is obviously you want to earn someone's vote, but I think the values piece is important because you're right. Conservatives do, you know, talk about values more often than Democrats, and that's what keeps something more sustainable over time versus just, like you said, the issues that are not necessarily things that people can relate to. But
if I would also say that, you know, just in this is something I think, Lauren, that you and Liam really hit on, is that, you know, for the Democratic coalition, right, its strength is its diversity. That's also its weakness. And I think also a lot of professional Democrats don't understand, and I think this is an important distinction, that whether or not it's, you know, upper income college educated whites, whether or not it's Latinos, African Americans, Asian American voters, they are more culturally conservative than the leadership of the Democratic Party in many places. That doesn't mean they're more socially conservative. I'm not talking about gay marriage or LGBT issues or abortion. But, you know, when you go into a community that is focused on family and education and community, and you discount those things, or even love of country, frankly, right? A lot of immigrants came here because they knew it was a better place to make a life for themselves and their families. So if you go in saying America is bad, when these people came from someplace that was objectively a far worse situation, it's very difficult to convince them that you guys share values, if that makes sense.
100%. And I want to go back to two things. I'm writing them down. Hopefully I don't forget them. Eitan, you said a minute ago, each party doesn't do a good job of policing its extremists, which is beautiful. Chef's kiss on that. You know, we talk a lot about essentially, you know, big words like illiberalism and on the left and on the right. But I don't think we have really delved into why we don't do a good job of policing our extremists. Do you have any sense of why that is? And, you know, maybe your possible solutions for helping to do better policing on that job?
I mean, well, I mean, I think the practical reason is, Friedrich Hayek wrote about this a while ago about why kind of big government regimes can do some nasty stuff. You start to see that your side needs to win, and any dissent from your side winning is a threat. And so you're willing to suppress any dissent in order to make sure your side wins. I think that we have this kind of winner-take-all politics moment where elections are really close. Everything is very close all the time. You often are just around the corner from winning the next fight, and you want to just, duck all of those kinds of things that might separate your own community from one another. Obviously, it's the other party's job in an election to showcase those cracks on the other side, and so that is—it's sort of like not the solution. That's like, you know, that is good or bad. It's just that's the solution. The other solution is that both parties get to show the other side where they're inconsistent, where they're kind of talking out of their, you know, to, and both parties do that, right? You can be in a Republican or conservative media environment and just be provided with example after example of when the Democrats are inconsistent with their own values, where they you know, they said one thing and then they say the other thing. And of course, if you're in a democratic liberal ecosystem, it's the opposite. And we, you know, like in a democracy, rely on the voters to suss out which party is the more reasonable one and more consistent with their values. But that's sort of how it plays out.
Well, and I would also say, just on the policing of the sides, right? On the Republican side, from my perspective, the group being policed are the non-extremists. The extremists are doing the policing. You can call it a purge. You can call whatever you want. I mean, look, after Trump's conviction, Larry Hogan says we should respect the rule of law. 5 minutes later, Trump's campaign manager, a guy named Chris LaCivita, said, your campaign is over, right? That's the policing action right there. Larry Hogan was the normal one. LaCivita was the extremist, and he was taking the police action against someone who was otherwise being normal.
And do you think, to even like, again, go back to your book, Eitan, do you think this pot of extremists on both sides cultivated by political hobbyism, do you think that has created this ecosystem where the extremists are doing the policing, like Reed said?
I mean, I guess it's a combination of factors, but I think that what we know in political science is that extremists usually lose, right? In a close race, and this just comes off exactly what Reed said. I mean, when there's a race between some far right or far left candidate and a moderate of the other party, the moderate wins most of the time, way more often than the extremist wins. So that's what voters want. I think that the fact that the parties are so nationalized that most Americans' views of politics is so focused on national politics creates this sort of caricature of everyone's opponents, so that the MAGA Republican, so-called, like the enemy that they are seeing is someone who truly does have very, very inconsistent values from them. They're paying attention to people on the far left in cities that are going to give Democrats, you know, 80% of the vote or whatever. And same thing for Democrats. You know, they're seeing the Republicans as evil. I mean, you know, there's a little study I did in the book about Red Sox and Yankee fans and Democrats and Republicans. And I asked, you know, Do you think Democrats, you'd be upset if your kid married a Republican? And do you think Red Sox fans, you'd be upset married a Yankee fan? And, you know, basically it's the same rate of people saying yes to those questions. And what's going on there, like, why would be a third of Democrats say they'd be upset if their kid married a Republican? The situation is like this. If you're a Democrat, say, in Massachusetts, and your kid marries a Republican, the Republican they're going to marry is probably some, like, Charlie Baker Republican who's pretty similar to them on a lot of dimensions. But in your mind's eye, the Republican you have in mind is someone who's like extreme and in a different part of the country and with a very different culture. And that happens because our views of those parties are so hyper nationalized. And they're nationalized because, again, just pulling on something Reid said, the demand in politics is for this juicy, sensationalized fight that's very emotional. And it's just so, so distinct from the actual policymaking that has to happen in legislatures. But nevertheless, that's what drives it. People, if we have like sort of a political campaign economy where you need to make an ad to get donations, then yeah, you're going to send the most emotion-driven thing that makes the other side look like the enemy.
And I want to get back to some of the premise of why we were having this conversation to begin with is about the suburbs, particularly, right? And how, like you were saying, the Charlie Baker Republicans in the suburbs are willing to work with moderate Democrats. You know, what are y'all thinking about the, I guess, essentially, you know, well, let me back up. So the majority of people who live in the suburbs in this country, I think it's like 70% of people live in the suburbs, right? So it's like the majority of the country is actually living in the suburbs. So a lot of what we're seeing is like this direct reflection of people who live in suburban areas and are voting and having federal and state and local level repercussions in it. But like, why did we see things shifting, trending toward Democrats in suburban places, particularly as we look at extremisms explicitly?
Well, I hate to say this, but I think that it's probably borne out by data that you all both have, is that if you live in the suburbs, you probably tend to be educated. You probably tend to be upper income. And as we've seen, as those two trend lines go up, there tends to be a diminishment in extremism, political extremism, because frankly, the system has worked for you, right? This is the smart America set. You're credentialed. You expect your kids to be credentialed, whether or not that's a good school district, whether or not it's a private school, whether or not that's a four-year university. And so you have no real vested interest in massive upheaval economically, socially, culturally. They are in some ways, you know, I don't know if they will be the silent majority, as Richard Nixon called them, but they have tended to be the leavening agent in American politics. I think the problem that we're seeing in this moment at a presidential level anyway, I don't think it holds as true at the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate level, is that leavening agent is being asked to deal with two choices, neither one of which it wants, if that makes sense. And so I think that, you know, this race in 2024 could really be the battle of the undervote. Remember that in, you know, everybody says, oh, well, you know, Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 because Trump won Michigan or because Jill Stein got more vote, you know, got so many votes. No, Hillary Clinton lost in 2016 because a whole bunch of Democrats who should have shown up for her didn't. Right. That's why she lost. That's why Trump lost in 20. In Wisconsin, 50,000 Republican voters left President blank. I think it was something like 15 or 20,000 in Georgia. Remember the famous, I need 11,428 votes or whatever it was. And so, you know, if you have a whole bunch of, you know, otherwise general election, 4-year general election voters saying, I'm just going to sit this one out, then it really becomes a base play. Right? Who can churn out their base more than the other one? And unfortunately, that drives more extremism because you have to say, you know, I'm for X, Y, and Z because I know that my activist voters need to hear that. And as you do that, you're leaving more and more of those suburban voters, Lauren, saying like, well, where do I go now? Right? And I think we've had so many years really since 2012 of the American electorate being, you know, focused on the lesser of two evils. You could argue that, you know, neither Barack Obama or Mitt Romney in 2012 or Obama and McCain in 2008 were perfect choices. No such thing. But I would venture to say that both of them were considered legitimate by the opposite party, if that makes sense. Like, maybe we didn't like them, but nobody ran around with the words fascist or incompetent, if that makes sense.
No, I love that. Sorry, I was taking notes on that because that's really good. So we have a few minutes left because I know we have to hop soon. So I want to go to a question. And before I ask that question, I'll ask this question that you guys can chew on because it'll be our final question. So we always ask at the very end, what are some depolarizing activities that people who are listening to this podcast can do in their day-to-day lives? So it can be anything from reading Eitan's book or, you know, doing something, which actually I think someone recommended that on our, one of our other kind of conversations about your book, which is great. And, or it could be, you know, running for state office as a moderate, whatever. So maybe chew on that. So, we were talking about the suburbs, just now, and I'm curious what y'all's thoughts are as, you know, the suburbs are increasingly becoming very diverse. You know, Black, Brown, Asian communities essentially are in the suburbs, not just white people in the suburbs. So like, what does that affect, do you think, what does that affect having on, suburban, electorate? And people's decision-making, particularly as we look to combat extremism. And I guess, what are y'all's thoughts essentially on that element of it?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say that I think that the kinds of issues that relate to families, to people being able to stay in healthy marriages, raising children, these are things that are not just like bread and butter issues. I think what we're seeing is increasing polarization even around these issues about, like, for example, like, what's the future of boys and men? This kind of research that's coming out that's saying, like, boys from basically birth are not in good shape relative to girls, and we need to have an agenda around that. Now, if the party's decision, like on the Democratic side, is to say, oh, well, our focus on gender stuff is just about getting, you know, women having equal pay and women having equal parity in STEM fields, and it doesn't address this, boys, then you'll see a couple things happen, right? You'll see that, and this really does transcend racial categories, because you asked about diversity, because there's a lot of problems, particularly around boys in minority communities. And they are latching on to like some pretty extreme stuff on social media that is giving them an answer to the questions of how boys are going to be able to grow up into successful working men in this economy. And that stuff is really going to be bad news. So the question is, can a party come forward not just on like sort of the boring bread and butter stuff, but on questions about sex, gender roles, marriage, and family, that is going to be like something that is a particular interest, I think, to folks who are trying to establish and maintain safe, healthy, family-oriented communities in suburbs.
Yeah, look, I mean, I would latch on to that too, is you know what? Most folks just want normal, right? They want normal. They want to be left alone. And they want to know, as we talked about a little bit, Lauren, before we went on, they want to know that if there's a set of rules, they apply to everybody equally. Now, do I know that that is impossible on some level? Do I know that there's not a lot of human history that demonstrates that? I do. But that doesn't mean that the striving for it doesn't matter. In fact, it maybe matters more than anything. And I think I'm going to get, you know, philosophical, and I'm going to lean on all my humanities because I'm not a math guy. Like, belief matters. Belief that we all deserve a shot matters. And to Eitan's point, that means whether or not we're a young woman of color or a young white man, an older immigrant, right? Or an older person who worked in a coal mine, we all want to know that somehow we've had our shot. We've had our ability to say, yes, this is what I would like to do. Now, again, That's a long way from saying we want to give everybody everything, because that's not realistic either. It's if given the opportunity, did you take it when it was offered to you? If you choose not to, that's on you, right? That's on you. We're not going to fix the human psyche of I'm willing to work for it or I'm not willing to work for it. But again, it goes back to this idea of if I say X and I get canceled because I have this trait, but somebody else says X and they get away with it, or an entire, you know, political party or movement is willing to come to their rescue because, as Eitan said, because my hypocrisy is okay, but yours isn't, right? Then that's where we get into trouble. And so I don't think that you have to promise everything to everyone, because that's a promise, frankly, no one believes. But you have to say, here I am trying to represent the best of all of us, not that person or this person, but the best of all of us, because we need to do the best we can for the largest number of people. Is that going to work? Not always, not even often, but that's where you have to start. And I will stop with that, because again, no one believes in anything, because as Eitan said, neither one of these parties is selling anything anybody wants to buy.
100%. And Eitan, I think we could go on a whole nother episode on Boys and Men. I think Richard Reeves is the one who wrote the book about that recently. Yeah. And he's starting since. Yeah. It's really fascinating and honestly just sad and scary stuff. So ending on our positive note on things that our listeners can do, depolarizing activities. You had a really, really intriguing anecdote in your book, Eitan, this lady, I think it was Lisa was her name, of like essentially de-escalating this fight on the subway or whatever. And she was saying, I think I wrote it down. She said, I started feeling that if we're going to save our democracy, we all really need to do work and do hard things. So what are these hard things? What are these depolarizing activities that we can be doing in our day-to-day lives that are going to help us in this crazy town that we're going?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, in this book I wrote, there's a bunch of stories of very inspiring people who are doing very, very ordinary things. And what makes them sort of like heroes in the book is that they're very good at getting 100 people to do something or 50 people to do something. That's hard. We need people to have heroes who like have that level of patience. You know, think about the person who's like the head of your condo board. Think about the person who's like on the, you know, ritual committee of your church. That think about the person who is, you know, maybe the on the school board. Like the kinds of politics that person has to do at the church, at the condo association, in the school board, those are people who we need to like elevate to be our heroes, because like they are getting things done and they're doing it because they have to build consensus because they're following the rules. And like, I think we just need to either do that stuff ourselves or at the very least understand that those are the people who sustain our democracy.
Reed, what you got?
Look, I would say this is, start at home, start in your local community, do things. Look, all of this stuff, politics is so downstream of all of these things, whether or not it's the school board, whether or not it's the PTA, whether or not it's, you know, coaching a kid's team and demonstrating decency and leadership, right? I remember, you know, coaching a softball team for my daughter and watching these are like, you know, they're 11 or something, right? Maybe 10. And the parents in the crowd freaking out about something. And just looking at the kids, looking at the girls on the bench going, that's not how we're going to act. And if there were parents on our team saying, that's not how we're going to act either, right? You could disagree with a call, or you can be upset about this. But the truth is that these kids are watching you. They're watching us. They want to see how we react. And if we react without any emotional regulation, right, then they're going to think that's the way I'm supposed to react to something I don't like or to something that doesn't go my way. And that's exactly the wrong thing. And I think that applies to, again, start at home, start in our communities. It's way too easy to just stare at our phones all day and sit in our houses and not know our neighbors and say, if it doesn't directly affect me, it's not my problem. Wrong, wrong. It's all our responsibility and it's all our problem.
Amazing. Beautiful. Thank you guys so much. This was so great. Reed, Eitan, I am just so grateful that y'all are doing amazing work and giving us some heroes to look up to. So thank you for all you're doing.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lon.